We've just celebrated Vesak, which celebrates the birth, the enlightenment, and the passing away of the Buddha. And many of you will have been present last night at the Supreme Court Gardens for a wonderful event to celebrate Vesak and also commemorate the 30th anniversary of the Buddhist Society. And I think it's not inappropriate to say thank you again to all those who helped out, who organised and who put a lot of effort into making last night's event truly memorable and very successful. It was an opportunity for people who are Buddhist to join together to celebrate, and also for people who aren't Buddhist to come together and see what Buddhists are like. It was interesting to mix with some of the people who'd come to report on the event and to speak to them and hear how surprised they were at the kind of people who were Buddhist. They were surprised to see so many Westerners, people who obviously weren't born into Buddhism and who were very much at ease with Buddhism. And they were surprised to see what a cross-section of people were Buddhist and how happy we all were, how at ease we all seemed to be. And this was an event that didn't have any alcohol. We were having a party without any grog, and yet everyone looked as though they were having a good time. And these were the comments that people were making who had come without any previous exposure to Buddhism. And they were going away with a very favourable impression. In fact, they told me they were a bit nervous to come, not having ever met any Buddhists or been with Buddhists before. They didn't really know what to expect. And they were not only pleasantly surprised, but they were very favourably impressed. So last night's event was successful to that extent in giving non-Buddhists the opportunity to have some first-hand experience of this religion. And tonight I'd like to talk around the theme of Buddhism as a living religion, particularly in the light of Vesak and the celebration last night. As I said in the Vesak celebration, as most of you probably are aware, we are celebrating the birth, enlightenment and passing away of the Buddha. And sometimes we might think, well, why are we celebrating the passing away? That's just a nice way of saying the death. And we don't usually celebrate anyone's death in a conventional sense. We mourn the passing away of those who've died. So why is it that this great teacher, this great being that we all look up to, we're celebrating that he's died? And this is quite a good question to reflect on, especially in the light of a living religion. Why are we celebrating death? And the reason that we celebrate the parinibbana, the passing away, the nibbana without remainder, nothing left, is because as we understand the teaching of the Buddha and as we understand what the Dharma is pointing to, we understand that all of us are caught on this wheel of birth and death, life after life, being born, living for some time, having some momentary pleasure and fulfillment, and then often having disappointment, and distress, living our life through the ups and downs, and then dying, only to be reborn again, to go through the whole thing again. And we might think, well, that doesn't sound too bad to me. I'd rather be doing that than not doing it. That's what happens when death is approaching. We'd rather be doing it than dying, even if it's not as good as we hoped or what we thought it was going to be. But the Buddha, in his enlightenment, through his practice, understood that this constant arising and passing away, which we call life as it's happening, and this constant arising and passing away, which we call birth and death, is in its ultimate sense suffering, unsatisfactory. It can never be ultimately fulfilling. And so to be able to break out of that cycle, to be able to transcend that cycle, and to free oneself of that cycle is to free oneself of suffering. And so at the passing away of the Buddha, we celebrate that here is a being who is not going to be reborn, who is not going to arise again anywhere in any of the realms of existence. Here is a being who has found their way out. And this is a celebration. And it's more of a celebration when we realize that this being has shown us the way to follow so that we too can find our way out. Until we understand suffering, we may not think it's a celebration, either the passing away of the Buddha or the idea that we can practice to not be reborn. So for each one of us, wherever we are, we have to keep on practicing to see if we can find anything, anywhere, any experience in this life that brings us ultimate fulfillment. If we can find anything like that, can we hang on to it? Do we have to let it go when we die? And what's that like? Having to see what we've worked so hard to accumulate, to develop, taken from us by death. And if we get a deep enough understanding of that, then we will make diligent effort to really follow in the Buddha's footsteps, to free ourselves of arising, passing away, arising, passing away, to also find our way out of this cycle of birth and death. We can understand why we celebrate the birth of the Buddha, we can understand why we celebrate his enlightenment, but we have to work towards being able to really feel in our heart the celebration of the passing away of the Buddha. But it's a celebration of someone who's become completely free of suffering. And when we celebrate Vesak, we realize we're celebrating events which took place 2,600 years ago. So what does it mean that Buddhism is a living religion for us in this day and age? First of all, is Buddhism a religion? Very often you hear the scholars, the experts say, well, Buddhism isn't really a religion, it's only a philosophy. And this is a very conservative definition of what is religion. a conservative definition that says that religions do deal with God and man, humans, relationship with God. And things that don't have God as the creator and the head of the religion, they're not really religions. So it's a view of what is a religion. It's a definition of what is a religion. It's saying this is how we describe what a religion is, and our definition is the ultimate, the right one. But we can say, well, we don't accept that definition of religion, that it has to include a God, because we don't, in Buddhism, have a creator God that we're all relating to. So we can redefine the definition of religion and say that a religion is something which helps us to understand our place in the scheme of things, our place in the cosmos, helps us understand the riddle of life. And certainly that is what Buddhism does. That is what the teaching of the Buddha, the Dharma, does. That's what it addresses directly. So Buddhism is very much a religion in those terms. And it's very much a living religion, because what it points to are realities. The Dharma is pointing to the truth. And it's not pointing to a truth that existed when the Buddha existed 2,600 years ago, but which no longer exists. It's pointing to ultimate realities that existed in the time of the Buddha and which are still evident now, playing themselves out now in our life, in the lives of all around us, in the world generally. When we chant the qualities of the Dharma, we chant that the Dharma is sanditiko, to be seen here and now. It's apparent, to be known right now. Because the truth that the Buddha was pointing to wasn't something that he manufactured or created. It's what he discovered the laws of nature. And he pointed out those laws of nature, and they can be seen right here and now because they are still the same laws of nature, even though the Buddha has passed away. So the laws of nature in the Buddha described in many different ways, but there are the three characteristics of existence, the tilakana, that everything that arises is only temporarily in existence. It has the ultimate nature to pass away. Anything, any being, anyone is impermanent, anicca. And because of that, and because things are following their nature and not following our wishes, they change whether we like it or not. They change not when we like it, but according to their nature. There is dukkha, because we can't control those laws of nature. Suffering. Unsatisfactoriness, imperfection. And even the things which we take to be me and mine, like this body, or like my house, or like my career, or my children, or my partner, these things don't really belong to me. They're only temporarily mine. Borrowed from nature. They're not self. And this is another source of suffering. We're not in control of the things that are closest to us. We're not in control of this body, and we're not in control of this mind. We can learn to be in control of this mind through the practice of the Dharma, the path of practice. But the untrained mind is the normal mind, the natural mind, flitting here and there, going from happiness to misery, past to future, anxiety, desire, all of those things. We have to learn how to take control of the mind. But in its ultimate sense, the mind is also not self. So these are three of the realities that the Buddha discovered and which he pointed to, which can be seen here and now. And then we also say that the Dharma is akaliko, not a matter of time. And that means that the fruits of this practice can be experienced in the moment as we do the practice. It's not a matter of waiting for a reward later on in this life when we get good enough, or in another life when we go to heaven, or next time around. The rewards, the fruits of the practice, can be experienced instantaneously. So, for example, when you were sitting in meditation and you were able to keep your attention continuously on the breath, just for two breaths, for example, you can notice that that has a calming effect on the mind. Just those two moments of mindfulness. If you're able to develop the meditation so that you can stay on the breath for longer periods of time, in one sitting you can experience a moment of peace, a moment of peace, a moment of peace. The fruit of the practice is evident right there and then. It's the same when we practice to keep the precepts. In the moment when we refrain from saying something cruel, when we feel like it, we catch it just before it gets out of our mouth. And in that moment of upholding our precepts and restraining the mind from acting in an unwholesome, unskillful way, right at that moment, if we're mindful enough, we will notice a feeling of inner ease that comes from that moment of wholesomeness in the mind, that moment of restraint. So the practice gives us immediate results. These are, again, some of the realities that the Buddha pointed out and which are able to be experienced right here and now. When we practice the Dharma, when we live as Buddhists, it's not just a matter of taking up a lifestyle and believing. We have to actually put the teaching to the test. We have to undertake a process of inner exploration, not only to apply the teaching, but to uncover what the teaching points to in our own experience. This is what makes the Dharma come to life for each one of us. The personal application and the individual investigation. This is what keeps it dynamic. This is what gives it vitality. What also gives it vitality is that we have people who have practiced well and who are able to pass on a deeper understanding of the Dharma through their own experience. So we're able to receive a transmission from other teachers who are able to speak to us from their own very deep and powerful experience. That also is what makes this a living religion. It's not a matter of just reading it in books and reading something that was tradition a long time ago. We can actually meet living embodiments of the teaching. And then from our side, what also gives it a vitality is that we bring our individual questions, our unanswered questions about life with us to the Dharma. In fact, that's what very often prompts us to take up Buddhism, to take a look at least at Buddhism, because we have unanswered questions. And it's those unanswered questions that impel us to go searching for answers. Because these are questions which make it impossible for us to be at peace with life, to be at peace with ourselves, to be at peace with the people around us. This inner urging to find an answer. And this is another vital aspect of Dharma practice, that we bring our questions to the Dharma. And in searching for answers and finding them, we bring the Dharma to life individually. And as much as we're able to do that and share that with others, we bring it to life for them also. This is what makes Buddhism a living religion, that keeps it dynamic. And any of you who've been practicing and hearing the talks for a long time will know that there's always something more to learn. Not something more to learn in terms of what the books tell us, but something more to learn about ourselves, about the way the mind works. Some other aspect of the teaching that we haven't seen before. We might have heard it many times, but we haven't actually realized it for ourselves. And as we continue to practice, we uncover that deeper level of meaning in our own experience. And that often helps us to see who we are at a deeper level, at a level that we hadn't even anticipated discovering. We see our unwholesome qualities more clearly, but we also see our strengths. We maybe glimpse the peace that the teachers have been talking about, that we've heard other people talking about. And we discover, this is a truth for me as well, that there is this inner peace within my own mind. So as we continue to practice, we bring the teaching into more and more life for ourselves. This is what keeps the Dharma alive. And when we look to see where is the best place to learn the lessons that we need to learn, we understand eventually that it's not in the books, it's not in other people's words, it's in our own heart. And once we discover this, there's a kind of relentless energy that keeps us going, keeps us looking, because it becomes very interesting to discover what there is to see. In the time of the Buddha, there's a nice story that points to this kind of inner exploration. The Buddha was sitting in the forest meditating one time, and a group of young men came up and asked him if he had seen a young woman going by. And he said to them, "Why are you looking for this young woman?" And he said, "Well, we decided to come into the forest to have a picnic today, and we brought our wives with us, but one of our friends didn't have a wife, so we hired a young woman to come with him as his companion. And we had a very nice time, and we had some great food to eat, and we all got a bit sleepy and decided that we'd have a rest. So we all lay down to sleep, and while we were sleeping, this young woman took all our valuables and ran off with them. And now we're trying to find her so that we can recover our valuables. So that's why we're searching for her." And the Buddha said to these young men, "Wouldn't it be better for you if you spent your time searching for yourself rather than searching for this young woman?" And these young men obviously had the ripeness to have an interest in the Dharma, because the Buddha's question set them thinking, what does he mean, search for yourself? What's he talking about? So they sat down to listen to what the Buddha had to say. And this is quite an interesting teaching, because it points out the way the Buddha introduced the teaching of the Dharma to those who had never heard it before. He didn't start with the very deep Dharma, because he knew that the minds of the listeners would not be ready, would not be able to take in what he was saying. And so he started by talking to them about the advantages of living a moral life, that one, by keeping the precepts, by establishing a standard of morality in one's life, that one is able to live happily with oneself and at ease with other people. And as one does that, one is able to use that as a foundation for further understanding, further exploration. And the Buddha went on to talk about how when one lives in that way, one has a feeling of inner ease. And that inner ease allows the mind to access some sense of inner peace. Instead of being embroiled all the time in conflict and getting lost in deceit or harming others, using one's speech wrongly, not telling the truth, because one keeps the precepts, one automatically, naturally feels much more inner peace. And then as one does that, one can start to reflect on one's life, to see where one finds true happiness and peace. Now, these were some young men who were obviously quite well off and able to afford to indulge their search for pleasure through sensual gratification, through being able to have nice food to eat, go to pleasant places, enjoy pretty women. And so the Buddha started to talk to them about the dangers in the pursuit of sensual pleasure. He started, first of all, to point out that if we make the pursuit of sensual pleasure the focus of our life, that we're really wasting our time. It's certain that having nice things to eat, going to nice places, being with lovely women might be pleasant, but only for a while. The problem with any kind of sensual gratification is that it doesn't last. And because it doesn't last, that in itself is vexing. Anyone who spent hours in the kitchen preparing a fabulous meal for the family or for friends knows the frustration when everyone eats it all up and it's gone and you have to go and not only clean up but also prepare another fabulous meal if you want to enjoy the same kind of pleasure again. And that's what happens with all sense pleasures. Only temporary happiness. And then the other thing is that we have to keep finding a little bit of diversity in our sensual gratification. It's not enough to have the same menu on the fabulous meal next time. We have to have something a little bit different next time. If we have the same thing over and over again, it no longer is the fabulous meal. It's not that again. And so even if we find something that satisfies for a while, it only does that if we don't have it too often. And we find that we have to expend a lot of energy, a lot of time in getting new and better things. We have to work hard to have the money to be able to afford to go and get another one. Or a different one. And so the pursuit of sensual gratification is a real treadmill that never comes to an end. And the Buddha started to talk about this to these young men. And he pointed out, even when you get what you want, you don't know really what you're getting with it. And this is what they'd experienced. They'd hired this beautiful young woman, expecting only to have pleasure, and here she had run off with all their valuables. So they understood when the Buddha talked about the danger in getting what you want. You may get more than you bargained for. And because of their situation, because they were actually experiencing that in their life right then, they were receptive to what the Buddha was saying. Now you can imagine that if they hadn't had this experience, they might have thought, well, what does he know about pleasure? Look at him, living in the forest, hasn't got a roof over his head. When it's cold, he's cold. When it's wet, he's wet. When it's hot, he's hot. Of course he'd think that life's miserable. And he hasn't got a beautiful woman to keep him company. He's all on his own here. What would he know about pleasure? He should get a life and then he'd know what was really happiness. But of course, firstly, they were experiencing the negative effects of the fact that they could afford to have what they wanted. And then they'd lost it and it had brought them trouble. And then they could see, well, here was this person sitting in the forest without a shelter, without the comforts, and yet he was obviously quite happy. So these two things made an impression on their mind. And it says in this particular teaching that they reflected on their own life and how much fulfillment they'd found, even though they'd been able to have what they wanted. And it says in this teaching that their minds became malleable, bright, uplifted and receptive. And when the Buddha understood, realized that their minds had opened to the Dharma, only then did he give them the deeper teaching, the teaching which is peculiar to the Buddhas, that is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths, the first one is that life is by its very nature unsatisfactory, it's inherently imperfect, and no matter how good we are, how clever we are, how healthy we are, how young we are, how wise we are, how rich we are, how beautiful we are, all of the things that we think will give us what we're looking for, none of those things is going to do it, because the nature of life is such. And because we don't understand life, we don't accept it, we try again and again to get it right because of our desire, then we are bound to suffer. So the second noble truth is that the cause of suffering is our craving. And the third noble truth is that there is a state of being which is beyond craving and beyond suffering, and that is the state of Nibbana. And it can be reached through following the fourth noble truth, the path of practice, the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is the teaching that the Buddha gave to these young men. And this is the teaching which he said would help them to find themselves. And when they would take up this teaching, what they would find was actually their not-self. When you take up this path, the path is actually leading each one of us to discover what we took to be me, what we took to be mine, but which actually isn't. And to keep on looking beyond that to what is that we haven't been able to see, that we haven't been able to experience because we've been wrongly assuming a self in the things which are not self. That might sound confusing for those of you who haven't much familiarity with the Dharma, or who haven't practiced in a way that has so far allowed you to see this. But when the Buddha said to these young men, isn't it more beneficial for you to find yourself? He wasn't saying that eventually they would find a self which was perfect, a self which was completely happy, a self in the sense of something which was beyond change. The truth that the Buddha was teaching, was pointing towards, was that when you unravel the whole ball, when you peel away each layer of the onion, you discover layer by layer all the things that you took to be self but which aren't, and that ultimately you take away the conditions for the arising of what you took to be a self. And it's in that unravelling that you find true peace. Now these young men, hearing the Dharma from the Buddha himself, were so inspired that they decided to leave home and take up the monastic life. And when we hear the teaching of the Buddha, when we hear the Dharma, parts of it will resonate with our own experience, parts of it will address the questions which we're facing in our own life, and some of it will seem way over our head or downright wrong. That's fine. That's the way it is. We have to take those parts of the Dharma which do speak to us and use them in our own life. explore them, investigate them, apply them, and see what they reveal. Because the words can never fully describe either what we're trying to do in the practice and also what we'll discover through doing the practice. And that's again what brings the Dharma to life. It's that unknown part, that surprise around the corner that we're going to get when we do see things clearly, when we do see the truth for ourselves. And that's what keeps the Dharma vital and dynamic, keeps our practice vital and dynamic, even now 2,600 years after the Buddha's passing away. So I encourage all of you to reflect on this in the light of your own experience of the Dharma and in the light of your own practice of the Dharma. To keep on bringing your own questions to the teaching and using those as the fuel, as the grist for the mill, to keep on going and keep on discovering these wonderful truths which the Buddha pointed out to us all. May this teaching be of benefit to you all, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.